Film Spotting is brought to you by PureFlix. Trade DVDs online at pureflix.com/filmspotting. And by Favre Forever.
Relive Brett Favre's finest moments and see how the NFL's only three-time MVP became one of the most beloved players in NFL history. Take the Lambeau Leap for Favre Forever, available now on DVD at profootballdvd.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. On this week's show, Catherine Hardwicke goes from The Lords of Dogtown to The Lord, plus Massacre Theater and music by Dead String Brothers.
Also, Adam and I pay tribute to the late Robert Altman with a conversation about his classic, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and reveal our top five good movies from bad directors. But first, the Nativity story.
There shall arise a star.
All of them talk of this prophetic king, this man who will defeat me.
The greatest of kings, born in the most humble of places.
Do not be afraid, Mary.
You have found favor with God.
Sam, if you look at director Catherine Hardwicke's short body of work so far, she's clearly interested in telling stories about rebellion, specifically about rebellious teens. 13, her 2003 debut, starred Evan Rachel Wood as a young girl clashing with her mother after discovering the wonderful world of sex and drugs. I think it was actually based somewhat on your life.
That's true.
Sam,
that's
growing
true.
Up in
yeah,
New Hampshire.
When I was a 13-year-old girl, that's
yes.
right.
And 2005's Lords of Dogtown chronicled the rise and fall of the Z-Boys, a group of Venice Beach teens in the 70s who revolutionized skateboarding by integrating surfing techniques and moves into their tricks. And that spirit of rebellion is certainly present here in her latest film, The Nativity Story, which is, of course, the story of a teenage girl in Nazareth, Mary, who is betrothed to an older man, Joseph, then goes away for a few months to visit her aunt and returns pregnant, despite the fact that she and Joseph have yet to consummate their marriage, a situation that brings shame to her, Joseph, and her family, and basically brands her as an outcast. I think the difference between her two previous films, and maybe you'll disagree with me, is that Hardwicke seemed to revel a bit more in the rebelliousness. She displayed a little bit more of an edgy, in-your-face style. I'm wondering if you were surprised at all then that the Nativity Story is pretty much exactly what the title suggests, the same Nativity Story we all grew up hearing and sang about in Christmas carols. And if you were surprised, Sam, was it a disappointment? Or considering how much we both really disliked Lords of Dogtown, do you perhaps prefer the softer, gentler, more reverential Catherine Hardwicke?
I think such a small percentage of the audience for this movie, and I'm not including the percentage, this doesn't equate the percentage of our Film Spotting audience. I think those that care or know that Catherine Hardwicke directed 13 and Lords of Dogtown before directing this, they're going to see the Nativity Story. I think it's
true.
A larger percentage of our audience that knows and cares who's directing this film. But to answer your question, you know, was I surprised? I think relieved might be the better answer here. Honestly, I did not want to see her reinterpretation of the Nativity Story, and I think I wasn't actually prepared for that to happen at all. I mean, you looked at the trailers and you saw this was going to be a pretty typical narrative. But what's interesting about this whole idea of Catherine Hardwicke directing this, knowing her previous work, is that for most people, they went to see the Nativity Story and they saw the Nativity Story. For us and our listeners, there was the added suspense of when is Evan Rachel Wood going to drop into Nazareth and drop acid with Mary and Joseph.
Uh-huh.
Of course, that doesn't happen.
It doesn't.
But there is that additional suspense. At what point will she really want to investigate the rebellion here of Mary? And I feel like I can't compare talking about this movie to any other movie we've talked about in the nearly 2 years of doing Film Spotting, in that if what you want to see is the girl from Whale Rider in the Nativity Story, I can't really say anything. I really can't come up with anything to dissuade you from doing that. That's exactly what it is.
Uh-huh.
That being said, I'm pretty sure you could go into any church basement in your town and see a Nativity Story as intelligently and insightfully directed. Catherine Hardwicke directed, I think, the worst film of last year. I mean, The Lords of Dogtown was terrible, and it was bad because of the way it was directed, for me. She directs in a way that, to me, strikes me as like a generality. There's a generality to her direction in terms of the way people fall into certain types and categories, and there's just no nuance to any of the characters, the way she directs characters. In Lords of Dogtown, it was just kind of chaos. Mm-hmm. I think describing Lords of Dogtown, it was like, run around and act crazy for the bulk of the film. In this film, the way people are played into types, I mean, King Herod, Kieran Hines, a good actor, the way he plays this villainous role mm-hmm. as a villain is, I'm serious, if you walk into any church basement and see a nativity story, you will see a King Herod played with more depth and nuance. And so that really, really troubled me. But she did just tell the nativity story, and the nativity story is a moving story.
Yeah.
And I was moved by it. I can't recommend this film as art, as film. Mm-hmm. But the story, I have to say, I mean, when we get to the end, it's very moving.
Okay.
And I want to say, and I want to let you jump in here and tell me what you think. So I will recommend it as the nativity story. Go ahead
really?
And see the nativity story. But I think we'll talk about Joseph a little bit, who
uh-huh.
I think absolutely carries this movie on
sure.
his back. He's fantastic, but go for it, Adam.
Okay, well, I think I had a little bit more of an expectation going in than you did, that we might see Catherine Hardwicke's take. And I did welcome that somewhat, even though I'm not a huge fan of Lords of Dogtown. I still thought, well, I'd like to see her vision of this, or anybody's vision of it, rather than
sure.
exactly what you're saying, just kind of
especially
your standard...
after, I mean, we just saw Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, exactly,
okay,
which
yeah.
I did think about a lot, quite frankly, during this film. So I wanted to see something new, a reinterpretation, not just a film that was, like you said, a church basement production, which is really what this is. And I will say, in her defense a little bit, I didn't like Lords of Dogtown either, not quite as much as you hated it, but I didn't like it either. I blame a lot of that more actually on the writer, maybe Stacey Peralta, for that film, who is actually one of the Z-Boys.
One of the Z-Boys.
And I'll just say the story behind Lords of Dogtown is actually a fascinating one. The documentary Dogtown Z-Boys is much better, much more interesting. But what I did like about this film, what I'll give some credit to it for, is, you know, I do like Keisha Castle Hughes as Mary, and as you said, Oscar Isaac as Joseph. And the parts where they interact with each other are the best scenes in this film. Her recognizing what kind of a man she's married to, has been forced to marry, and slowly realizing that she does love this guy and that he is a good man. And he loving her, but as this process goes on, coming to love her even more. I thought that was all really interesting. And I thought they, as actors, made characters believable and relatable to us, not just as legends, kind of the same way Kirsten Dunst and Sofia Coppola did in Marie Antoinette. So I will also say that I think we had maybe a little bit of a different experience where you, by the end of it, ended up being moved by it. I was actually really enjoying the film, and then by the time we got to the end, felt sort of bludgeoned with the religion, in a way, sort of bludgeoned by her reverence for the story, that I came completely disengaged from the film at that point and can't really recommend the film. And I realized that what it is, I think what's wrong with this film on some level, is that it's not inherently interesting, I don't think, as drama, to watch people who are absolutely convinced that what they're doing is right. It just doesn't make for good drama. There is no conflict. There's no development of character. There's no real revelations. She knows that she's giving birth to the Son of God. She's fine with it. Joseph has a dream, has a vision. He knows that he's married to a woman. Yes, it's going to be hard, but he's going to marry this girl, and she's going to have the Son of God, and he's fine with that too. And Hardwicke, I think, tries to, of course, manufacture the drama, play it up a little bit in the conflict by framing the story with Herod, as you said, a very conventional villain. He's ordering the murder of all the young boys in Bethlehem. We know that story. And that's the framing device here. So that's the tension. Oh, are they going to kill the child? Kind of. That's her attempt to kind of have drama there. And the way the town responds to her, being an outcast, is, of course, the other conflict and drama. But not enough time is really spent on it. And I even felt at one point the worst example, or the spot where you really could tell that Hardwicke was reaching to try to create some conflict, is they're crossing a river on the mule. She's Mary's on the mule. The action scene, right? And the mule slips or whatever, and she slips and falls off, and Joseph has to rescue her. And the scene really serves no purpose in the film whatsoever, I think, except to add a bit of not only just action, but actually like drama, of actual conflict, of, oh God, something's going wrong. No pun. Sorry for the pun there. But, you know, that all of a sudden something has to happen, because otherwise they're just heading to their destiny. And that's not interesting.
Right.
It's not.
Yeah, I agree, but this is where it comes to where my frequent criticism, I think, of films that have bad people doing bad things to each other, mm-hmm. is, you know, where if a film contains those characters, and then the film is maybe badly written or directed, I am unforgiving of it. I just hate it. It's just, I hate spending time with those kind of characters. In this case, you have a film that's badly written and directed, but the characters are good. And I think their struggle in some way, in terms of, you know, Joseph's his forgiveness of mm-hmm. Mary, and also his understanding of her. Of course, he's helped by the fact that the angel Gabriel sort of fills him in on yes. what's going on. But there's enough drama there, I think, okay. in terms of that character and what they have to do to get to Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. And that was all fine and good. And it's like, so it wasn't really creatively done or interpreted. But the story, again, contains yeah. enough drama for me, and they're good characters doing something yeah. good. And I have to say, like, I was not raised in the church. I'm a complete heathen when it comes to that. So as familiar as we are with this story, of course, I mean, it's just, you mm-hmm. you can't not be. I was having the most obvious revelations about Christianity. Again, okay. not growing up in the church, but this idea that I thought was really interesting, this idea, and again, forgive me for stating really obvious stuff here, but the idea of Joseph and Mary being the first Christians in some way, the first people whose lives were impacted by Christ, mm-hmm. By this figure that will change the world, and also that Joseph is the perfect embodiment of Christian values in yeah. some way. He's forgiving. He'll mm-hmm. do. He'll act for his brother, for his wife, more than he will for himself. And there's this really, it made me think of this really interesting idea of nature versus nurture. Yes, he's the son of God, but he's also Joseph's the son of Joseph, him. And yeah. Joseph's going to raise him. And I thought that was sort of interesting, and I think it works particularly well because Oscar Isaac as Joseph, like I said, I mean, he is wonderful. He has a kind of patience and depth, and mm-hmm. he's really engaged in every scene he is in yeah. a way that even Keisha Castle Hughes, who is wonderfully cast, I'm not sure does anything with the performance. I just think she's wonderful.
I agree with
cast.
You. I agree with you on both of those points. But I think for me, and again, on this show, our whole point is just to try and articulate our thoughts. I really don't care how other people in the right. grand scheme of things are right. responding to this. I'm not trying to speak for a group of people, but the only people I can think of that will go to this film and really enjoy it are the people who maybe were raised in the church and who will go and will really enjoy seeing sort of the Nativity story's greatest hits. They're going to watch and they're going to see, yep, oh, everyone at the inn, they're turning Joseph away. You know, he's looking for room. He has to find it at the manger. And hey, it's the three wise men, and they bring gold.
You mean the comic relief, three
yeah,
wise men?
Which
unbelievable.
Didn't work at all.
Doesn't work at all. Relief. And it really is. That's where it was like, I realized, like, this is community theater.
Yeah. That's what it felt like. Story. And they show up and they bring the three gifts we know they're going to bring. And, oh, that's fun if that's what you're going for. But honestly, for me, it's one thing, I think, to have reverence for this story, the Nativity story, and respect for it, which she, Hardwick, and the screenwriter, Mike Rich, they should have. But it's another thing, I think, to just play it completely safe and boring and not remotely try to challenge.
As if it's never been told before.
Exactly. And try yeah. to, they don't even remotely try to challenge the audience. And I couldn't believe that by the end of it, we see the light from the three planets that align together shining
a
down on them
light.
For like the last 10 minutes of the film. And we actually hear Silent Night. That's her approach to this is yeah. to, again, we're back to community theater, your church basement. I really couldn't believe it. I'm convinced that you could have told this same story in a different way and still made it not only acceptable for a religious audience, but a more interesting and relevant story to a secular audience. And whether it was Hardwick or Mike Rich, the screenwriter, or the studio, they absolutely, I think, chose to make this a movie that is as safe and harmless as possible, that it just would not offend anyone. And that, for me, just by the end of it, it didn't work for me. I was totally out of it by the end of the film.
Well, I want to point out one other thing that did work for me, which is just a geographical choice on Hardwick's part, is just the fact that this is told in a, you know, in the real geographical context, or what looks like.
I yeah, don't
know
sure.
where the, and that itself was interesting, just to see the physical obstacles that needed to be overcome, the 100 miles they needed to mm-hmm. overcome. That was
yeah.
just like a physical reality yeah. that was imagined, and that is completely interesting to me. But
yeah.
like you said, all you have to do, and this is not easy, but certainly so Sofia Coppola showed what you can do by really imagining what it is to be these people. Well, you know, ignoring the mm-hmm. fact that these are, you know,
mythical figures
right. that these were once real people,
right.
and she just couldn't do
she
it.
She doesn't quite get it. And the last thing I'll say about this issue of faith is simply that I think that it's fine that by the end they want to make a movie that is affirming faith, and that the characters by the end affirm their faith. But I think actually to make that task a little bit more arduous, to make the path to their faith a little bit more challenging, by the end even makes the faith even more rewarding
totally
and interesting.
Agree.
So that I think that I'm not just suggesting that they should have somehow taken the religion out of this and then a very religious audience would have found it objectionable. I don't think so. I think you could have done both, and I think they just chose to keep it as safe,
safe
as possible.
Totally agree. All right. Well, if you've seen the Nativity Story and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. Or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
When we come back, just because it is bad doesn't mean it can't be ambitiously bad. Listener feedback is next. Stay with us.
Get up, Jay. It's late in the morning. The rain is pouring. We got work to do. Get up, Jay. It's no need to lie. You tell me that you're dying.
Sam, this is Eric in Kettering, Ohio. Gotta say, I love listening to you guys call each other film snobs. You're film snobs, but we love listening to you anyway. Your Adrenaline Rush list call out was great, but I think I might add a couple more possibles. How about the first time the T-Rex attacks the kids in the Ford Explorer in Jurassic Park, and the lead up to the big fight between Lucy Liu and Uma Thurman. There you go. Two big adrenaline rushes for me.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, and thank you, Eric, for that great voicemail there. Jurassic Park isn't a movie, Sam, that gets me all that excited, but certainly
I remember
Kill Bill
being
scene.
In the audience in 93 and absolutely having that feeling. Absolutely.
I think I had it more the first time you just saw the dinosaurs, that big scene where they're running, you know, on the island. It was pretty breathtaking at that point, but certainly Kill Bill is a film we both
question.
Love. I think actually our good friend M. Robert Turnage, who we're going to hear from later in this segment, has so scared us away from bringing up that film because he hates it so much, and he always
says
these
We better have a damn good reason if we're going to mention
horrible,
Kill Bill.
Emails. You're right. Exactly. We have to have a good reason. So, well, let's take a quick moment to talk about new DVDs out this week, the Criterion Collection of The Maisels, cult documentary Great Gardens, which a number of people recently, not only listeners, but our good friend Matty Ballgame, I think it was, said we have to see it. It's actually at the top of my queue right now. Grey Gardens, and then Idlewild from Outkast. Sam, you actually saw this last year.
Did
we talk about it on the
show?
We
did briefly, I think, in my sort of like, I saw five movies that I didn't get to see,
and
including Idlewild, and I did see it, and
it's not
it did nothing for me.
Okay. Also, Beer Fest, which we didn't see, and one that we're both really excited about,
man.
The Conformist Special Extended Edition.
Extra existentialism.
There you go.
Yeah, right.
Bonus existentialism and misery, which is great because this is a Bertolucci film that's come up a couple of times on both of our top fives, and it's a film that hasn't been out on DVD until now. I remember actually going to a store back in high school after I first saw this film. Maybe it was college. It was college. And going to a store over Christmas break and putting down a deposit on the Laserdisc.
Wow.
Because I just wanted to own it
so bad,
you know, and I don't think I ever got it. I think I paid $5 and never got it.
Never came.
And now it's out on DVD. Also out, How to Eat Fried Worms and Miami Vice, a Michael Mann film. We split on a little bit.
Right.
I liked it more than you. Also out, the premier Frank Capra collection, Pulse, and a special two-disc edition of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Excited about that. And finally, Pirates of the Caribbean 2, Dead Man's Chest.
Sign up for a free PeerFlix account at peerflix.com/filmspotting by this Friday, December 8th at 6 p.m. Pacific time, and you'll be entered to win Pirates of the Caribbean 2, Dead Man's Chest, a movie We didn't love.
We really
we didn't even like it at all.
In
fact, but it was a huge box office smash. So for those of you that, and a lot of people, I know a lot of listeners did like it, had a good time, and accused us of not being able to have a good time.
That's right.
You know, go to PureFlix, sign up for an account, and you can be eligible for a chance to win. Last week's PureFlix DVD giveaway winner of Superman Returns, out now on DVD, is Freddie Mullins from Clintwood, Virginia. Congratulations, Freddie. Look for your copy of Superman Returns soon, courtesy of PureFlix.
All right. Congratulations, Freddie. And let's spend a few moments now thanking our listeners who were so generous to go to filmspotting.net, throw a few bucks our way via the PayPal link. Sam,
yes,
we have some nicknames, and of course all the nicknames are available on our site. The link is in the notes for this show. Who would we like to thank this week, Sam?
First, we'd like to thank Silver Club member Jay Fire and Flesh, Christopher the Passive Aggressor.
Nice.
Simon, I'm a Savant, deal with it. Rodney, Death Metal Fugitive. And Walter, the Starling of Avon.
Okay.
Nice.
Okay. I like it. Well, again, thank you to everyone who donated. Right now, it's also time to do poll questions. And
yes,
you can go to filmspotting.net, not only donate
nice
if you want to, but you can also vote in the Film Spotting poll. Last week's question, we asked the question, Sam, Robert Altman's masterpiece is?
Is MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Shortcuts, The Player, or Gosford Park, or other, and we should explain that as we did last week, other
is Nashville,
meaning
basically
Nashville.
I just completely, when putting the poll question together, it's right, not that I forgot Nashville, I just literally forgot to leave it out of
yes
the poll question,
right,
so I apologize.
All right, well, coming in at number one, Robert Altman's masterpiece, according to 26% of you, is MASH. 20% of you said the Nashville, a.k.a. Other, followed by The Player at 19%, then Gosford Park at 16%, McCabe and Mrs. Miller at 9%, and Shortcuts at 9%. Basically, really interesting how it's broken up here. I think a lot of people have their favorite Altman, probably had a hard time deciding what
yeah
their favorite Altman
yeah
was, honestly,
I
as
so
I did. Of course, I mean, I love Nashville. I think I would have voted for Nashville. But I have a lot of love for Gosford mm-hmm Park, and I was actually happy to see that it ranked as high
yeah
as it did.
Yeah, it did rank very high. Okay, this week's poll question, we're letting you dictate
yes
content on Film Spotting. I think I know the answer to this one, Sam, as I told you, but we're
you
both
seem confident
curious. We're going to review only one of these new movies opening next week on our next show. We want to know which one you think we should definitely focus on. So, which movie should we review on Film Spotting number 140?
That's right. Mel Gibson's Apocalypto or Ed Zwick's Blood Diamond?
I think it says Ed Zwick's right above the title, too.
A film by Ed Zwick.
Yeah, so
that's right.
Edward Zwick's Blood Diamond or Mel Gibson's Apocalypto. We're going to review one
yeah
of those two, and we're going to review whichever one you guys vote and tell us to. So go to filmspotting.net and please vote in that poll. We'll also mention, we did say on our last week's show that we were going to review For Your Consideration. You saw it.
I didn't
have a chance to see the latest Christopher Guest mockumentary or
right
whatever it is. It's not a mockumentary in this case, is it actually?
No, it's yeah, I think it falls under that category anyway.
Anyway, just
that's how they describe
Guest
Christopher Guest movies. Yeah,
I haven't seen it yet. You did. We will discuss it on a later edition of Film Spotting,
yes,
probably the bonus show at the end of the month,
right,
but we aren't going to get to it on this show. Last week was a crazy week for me, and then you throw in the fact that we had not only The Fountain to discuss, but Grave of the Fireflies.
Man.
Last week's was like the
punishing
deepest show for us ever in terms of just, I don't know that it came out that way. I'm just saying for us
no,
to do
no, right,
the work that went into it was hard. And
yeah
this week to just have the Nativity story.
The spiritual
and to,
labor.
Yeah,
to do,
there you go. And so now to just kind of do our normal show, it feels good. So anyway.
Nativity story.
Yeah.
Or up where we belong.
Yeah. So let's get to a little bit of feedback now, Sam, on the movie
the
we
Fountain
discussed last week, The Fountain.
That's right. Okay. Benjamin Churlin writes, I'm glad that neither of you panned this movie as bad as many critics already have, 50% on Rotten Tomatoes. I acknowledge the movie had its flaws, and I think you pointed them out nicely. But as you said, the visual style is so beautiful, poetic almost, in its repeating imagery, motifs, and style. I was so captivated by the film throughout that I didn't turn my head once, simply because of its visual impact.
Maybe Ben can write my notes for me next time.
That was well
could
done,
I have
isn't
just
it
said that instead of everything I said?
The repeating imagery motifs?
Yeah.
Yeah, you went on forever trying to
thank
describe
you
that.
I know.
All right, no. I think Adam was trying to articulate that Hugh Jackman's characters are the everyman, so we can relate to him. Part of Weiss's problem was that her role didn't call for any realism. She was a spirit guide in all three storylines, nothing more. It's also interesting that the most innocent of the two is the woman, when it is Eve who first ate the fruit of knowledge.
Okay.
On a side note, Did you know that no CGI was used in this movie? There was an interesting article in Wired about the film and the arduous journey undertook by Aronofsky to make it. I think a lot of it was left on the cutting room floor after its many script iterations. The nebula scenes were actually small amounts of liquids like iodine and baby oil mixed together.
Cool, huh?
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, no, a great email. And I think
I read that article.
I'm familiar, but it didn't come up, and it's worth noting. And I think it actually can make particularly some of those final scenes all the more impactful when you know how he did it.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoyed that, the lack of CGI. And also, I think you really hit on something that I said to you. I know you're going to disagree with us, but I said to you even after the show, we were in our car driving to the train station, and I was trying to justify Rachel Weisz's performance a little bit to you, and I think he's exactly right. I was trying to say that this is really Hugh Jackman's character, Tom's story, and she really is almost just a symbolic presence. She's the impetus for the entire story. She's supposed to be someone who is, in a way, above it all. And I think what your argument is that even in this world, though, that's the realistic world, where they're a married couple, she should have behaved like that and not some star child.
I think there could have been more
something.
Of an effort. Yeah, I mean, I love that description of her as a spiritual guide, and that would dictate her performance in some way. But for me, and this is a criticism of Aronofsky and Weisz, is that she is playing the part of a spiritual guide. And that's what annoys me.
Okay.
I think there's a way to play that you know, isn't a comment on playing it in some way. And I think that's what she does.
I think you may be more right than wrong in this case. I think if you look at her performance, it's a little stylized.
A little bit.
Okay. Well, let's read this one here from Chris Fry, who says, I'm curious to hear what your reaction was to the shadow kung fu of Jackman against the nighttime sky in the opening minutes of The Fountain. I think I actually felt a collective cringe amongst the moviegoers around me. I actually had that same cringe.
You cringe too?
I mean,
it's in the trailer, so I was
ready
for it.
I don't remember it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. After the final painstakingly extended CGI or not sequence faded from the screen, I did leave the movie glad I'd seen it, but confused as to why Richard Gere hadn't signed on as an executive producer due to numerous times Hugh Jackman struck poses similar to a meditating Buddhist monk. I applaud Aronofsky for his ambition/vision. Instead of churning out Hollywoodized pablum on love and loss, he managed to create a fable that challenges you to keep up. Sure, the film's a tad pretentious, but I think there's enough in the movie that the director does write to make it worthwhile, but not one I'd recommend to just anyone. I think Chris says it
totally
pretty well.
Fair.
I think
the
reason why we wanted to read his email actually is something I said to you, where I have The Fountain now on DVD. They sent out, you know, for my awards consideration, and I was watching it before our review, and it did occur to me, even though I do like the movie, recommend it for the reasons that Chris said, and also Ben, is that if you watch it, you could enjoy the whole film as unintentional comedy.
Yeah,
and I think that moment of the kung fu, you know, the meditating guy against the nighttime sky, that falls into that. But I was just thinking in particular of the opening scene where it's kind of the Raiders of the Lost Ark type moment. And there's a scene where it's the close-up of Hugh Jackman. I told you about this, Sam, where the guide, the Mayan guy appears at the end of the halt, the cavern thing they're in or whatever. And the guy to his right says, look over there or whatever. And they cut to Hugh Jackman. He goes, I see him. Yeah. And it's just everything about the way that's done. You could really have fun, like making fun of that, the way they're talking, how dramatic it is. And just the dialogue seems a little stiff.
I think my point is this didn't come to me there. And I am not condoning this behavior, but I'm saying this movie seems tailor made for reefer addicts. Really, it's a bit of a downer, but for those pot smokers out there, I feel like this movie may be the frat house special on a bit of a downer. It's a rainy day at the frat house.
Sam Van Hollegren from High Times Magazine.
Seriously, put me on the recommends.
Stars.
Yeah, this is your reefer hit of the year.
Okay.
But also this idea, and I think you're right. I think this almost requires seeing in the temple that is the theater.
Maybe.
I think the temple that is the movie theater. I think Aronofsky, absolutely, you can absolutely be submerged in a way in the music and you can't be distracted by anything else. I agree. Watching this on DVD with a bunch of kids running around or something while you're smoking reefer, but that would be a challenge. I totally agree. So I do. Those people that are curious at all, I really recommend going and seeing in the theater if that's an opportunity for you.
Okay. Well, last week's top five was, of course, ambitious films, tying in with Altman a little bit, but mainly with Aronofsky. And The Fountain. And Sam, we're going to save some of this feedback here, or the bulk of it, for the top five segment later in the show. Why don't you get us started here with Josh's email?
Right. Josh, writing from Chicago, writes, some movies that I hope meet either of your criteria. Life is Beautiful, more than any other Holocaust movie like Schindler's List or The Pianist. I think this one ranks because it's made by Roberto Benigni, a man whose resume consists of a film called Sex Monster. It's like Ricky Gervais's Extras, where Ben Stiller is trying to make a movie about the Holocaust. It's more ambitious than Spielberg and Polanski. because it's a pseudo zany film about a man trying to convince his son that the Holocaust is a game where the winner receives a tank. Try to pitch that to studio execs. Josh also has The Passion of the Christ. I mean, seriously, Josh writes, this is a no-brainer. A film about the death of Jesus told in dead languages. This selection may be replaced once I see Apocalypto. That Mel sure is crazy. That Mel sure is a crazy biatch.
Okay, Josh.
Josh writes, that is not an ad lib on my part.
No, thank you, Josh Ratty here in Chicago. My comments briefly, I'll comment first on Passion, where that's a film where I just want to admit I didn't see it. We weren't doing film spotting when that movie came out. I did not see it in the theater. I've yet to see it. It's been hard to get me to want to sit down and subject myself to that. But with Apocalypto coming out, I have it at home. I'm watching it this week. Life is beautiful. We've talked about before a little bit. I love Josh's argument, the idea of like explaining that to a studio exec or whatever, and he makes a good...
It's an ambitious pitch.
It is an ambitious pitch, and it's maybe ambitious in light of Benigni's other work, but I find that whole movie so just ridiculous that I just can't recommend it.
I'm afraid I have to agree. We'll wait till next week when listeners say otherwise. All right, well, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, I got poetry in me. I do. Got enough sense not to try and write it down. Adam and I have a conversation about Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Plus another edition of Massacre Theater. Stay with us. You know we've always been such good friends. You never judged me for the shape I'm in. You never judged me, honey, you just smile. And when you do, you know I walk that mile. I said, hey, who you think you are?
Political scare you?
Political doesn't scare me. Radical political scares me. Political scares me.
Politely politically radical. But
is it funny?
It's funny.
It's a funny political thing.
It's a funny thing. It's a thriller, too.
It's a thriller.
And it's all at once.
So what's the story?
Well, I want Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. I think I can talk to him. It's a story about a senator, a bad guy senator at first. And he's traveling around the country on the country's dime, you know, like that Sununu guy used to.
I see. So sort of a cynical political thriller comedy.
Yeah, but it's got a heart in the right spot. Uh-huh. And anyway, he has an accident. And he becomes clairvoyant, like a psychic.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a psychic political thriller comedy with a heart.
With a heart. And not unlike Ghost meets Manchurian Candidate.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Last week, Adam and I massacred Robert Altman's The Player, a tie-in with last week's top five ambitious movies, and a little tribute to Altman himself. Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Joran Kane from Valdosta,
Kane. Nice. That's
Georgia.
A familiar name.
It is. Congratulations, Joran. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
All right, it's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and as always, it ties in with our top five, which is in this case, and you'll have to explain why later we went with this top five,
yeah.
Sam. I'm not sure there's a good reason.
How did I?
Maybe tying in with Hardwick,
I have
perhaps,
no idea. Maybe. Actually, that's a good point.
Yeah. Good movies by bad directors.
Right.
So I will just say, by way of maybe a little bit of a hint,
yeah.
that Sam, you're the one who really thinks this director is a bad director. I'm not willing to go on the record and say that this person is a bad director, but there's no doubt that this film is the best movie by that director.
And interesting, too, we have reviewed a film by this director relatively recently, and I'm the one that gave it a positive-ish
review. Okay, now you're really giving hints away.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get started with it then, Sam. I start, you give me the action.
And action.
I got an award once from the mayor.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a long time ago. I've kind of been retired for a while. You're my very first client back.
You use needles?
No.
Not even little ones that aren't supposed to hurt?
No.
That's good. I'm going to see you again, right?
If it's okay with you. And scene. That's kind of tough, though, I think, actually.
That's tough. That's a tough scene.
If you think of this film, I don't know that that's the scene you think of.
That's
so
true.
We'll see where people come out. If you know what film Sam and I just massacred, send us an email by Monday, December 10th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show.
All right. It's time to honor the life of Altman with more than just a very short...
Very short.
Moment of silence.
Apparently, it was a too short moment of
too
silence
short
for some people.
I apologize.
Yeah.
All right. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, just a background a little bit. Neither you and I, before this week, had seen the film or embarrassed by it. It was number one, actually, on my movies I'm embarrassed I haven't seen list. And that was last April 2005. Yeah. And I'm finally getting around to seeing it. Briefly, as a setup, Warren Beatty plays John McCabe, an ambitious small-time gambler who comes to a small pioneer mining town in the turn of the century Northwest and sets up a bar, gambling house, whorehouse. He does with some success, but his lot improves when a smart madam, played by Julie Christie, comes to town and becomes his business partner. Trouble starts when the local mining company, wary of McCabe's success, tries to buy McCabe out. Of course, this is an Altman film, so the story really is as simple as that, and at the same time, it's not at all that simple. And Adam, as we discussed earlier in the show, our poll question last week was, what is Altman's masterpiece? You said last week The Player, I said Nashville. Now that you've seen McCabe, have you changed your mind?
Well, it's a good question because, of course, masterpiece could give the idea that it may not be my favorite film, but his greatest achievement. In some ways, McCabe might fit that bill. Nashville could. Shortcuts could. For me, I'm sticking with The Player in terms of the poll question just because, like several of our listeners wrote in, it was my introduction to Altman. You know, that was the film I saw first and then went back and saw other Altman films, and I still love The Player. So I'm probably going to stick with that. But I did like this film, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, a lot, just as I expected to. But before I really get into my reasons why, Sam, I have to bring up something that I can't believe you didn't catch on. I asked you about
this. Waiting for this all afternoon.
If you had noticed any coincidence spotting we talk about sometimes. And sometimes it's just amazing how things that are totally unexpected, like obviously us discussing McCabe and Mrs. Miller was never on the schedule, and we do it the same week as The Nativity Story. Just works out that way.
Right.
So what happens? I'm watching McCabe and Mrs. Miller. I don't know how you missed it, Sam, but... The opening
All right, I didn't actually
credits.
Say McCabe and Mrs.
You didn't,
Miller.
Did you?
No, no.
Yeah. The opening credits of the film, we hear a Leonard Cohen song,
oh,
as
yeah.
we hear throughout the film.
Oh, God.
And the Leonard Cohen song is called Stranger Song.
Yeah.
And the song includes this refrain, I kid you not. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. In fact, that's the last line of music we hear before the movie begins.
Yeah.
When McCabe walks into the bar.
Oh, I'm getting chills because that music is so beautiful.
It is.
And so well used. And it's interesting. I couldn't get my VCR to work. I had this videotape, and I've had this videotape lying around forever. Could not get all I was getting was sound and no image. So I actually just, it was playing. All I was getting was sound. And of course, the first, you know, 7-8 minutes are like almost indecipherable conversation. But with Leonard Cohen's song.
Yeah.
And it's just the most beautiful song. And honestly, that was a great way to get into the film. It's almost distracting and even harder to understand what people are saying by watching it. Just listening to it. It's just as powerful. And the music itself stands on its own.
Yeah, it is. So anyway, I had to point that out, though. I'm listening to that going, Joseph looking for a major
amazing.
Nativity story? Yeah. Okay, well, anyway. This, of course, McCabe is, you know, what's regarded his 1971 film as his anti-Western, and we spent a whole, you know, 8 weeks, 2 months on a Western marathon getting kind of a background in these a little bit, and so watching it in that context, with that experience of those eight films, that's really, for me, beyond it just being an interesting Altman film and having his style and the way the audio is used, as you mentioned, the way it's shot, and of course, Julie Christie and Warren Beatty, I think watching it in that Western context is really fascinating. This is a case where it is an anti-Western. Things happen that you would never see happen, never should have happened in the old West. And, of course, this is now turn-of-the-century West. It's, again, everything is kind of being faded into the back.
Right. And industrialization
is rearing its head now. Anachronistic. But here, men get shot for no reason.
Right.
Men get shot in the back. Our hero shoots men in the back. There's no law whatsoever. How many films do we see that had a sheriff in it? Even films like Unforgiven have a sheriff that is, of course, a bad guy, but there is some presence of the law. There's no law
Or even High Noon or something.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
The
public's relationship with the sheriff is altered in some way.
Sure, but here, it's just not there at all.
Right.
And then you get to the woman, of course, Mrs. Miller, Julie Christie, who she's unlike any woman we've ever seen, and that she's not just giving sass back to McCabe the way maybe Anne Margaret does in Rio Bravo, but she's clearly his superior, McCabe's superior in just about every way, just as a talker, as a businesswoman. She controls all of their interactions, and that, of course, is kind of jaw-dropping in a Western context. And there's even a point where McCabe, we don't see it. He's got his back turned, but it's very clear that McCabe is crying at one point, spilling his heart to his woman, mm-hmm. who isn't even really his woman because he's paying her for sex, because she's a whore, and he's crying, and she has to comfort him like a child. That's all sort of shocking. And again, this is something we talked about with The Wild Bunch, the last film in our marathon, where you're watching modernity, as you said, industrialization encroaching. You know, it makes the traditional cowboy or the gunfighter, the frontiersman, whatever, useless. At even one point, there's that self-referential joke where he makes a little one-liner, and she says, "Ah, the frontier wit," I guess, right? And and at the end of the film, we get to the end of the film, and there's a fire truck, which is, of course, a new invention, and they're very excited about the fact that they're able to put out the fire that's happened in this church with their fire truck. And, of course, they're juxtaposing that. Altman's intercutting that with the death of our hero, the death of the gunfighter, and it works really perfectly. And I just have to say that the thing that's so amazing about this film is there's a sense of dread that's so palpable, because there's a sense that when you watch it, what you take away from it is, why get excited about anything? Like, why, what I really took away from it is, why build something that you love, have a dream that you're very invested in, and something that it's for yourself, if someone can come along and force you out of it, whether it's by buying you or simply killing you? Yeah. And I think this is actually what Mrs. Miller understands. This is why she spends most of the movie in an opium-induced haze and doesn't really allow herself to really fall in love with Warren Beatty, with McCabe, even though she is. That she understands this. She understands that, like, there's no dreams anymore. Like, you know what? Wow. You do what you can. When you get an offer from someone to buy this thing that you've started from scratch, from the ground up, you sell it, because it's only going to lead you to misery.
And that's the only thing really they agree depressing. On in some
it
way.
Is,
yeah.
yeah.
Right. You made some wonderful points, and I think it's fair to say that you can absolutely see this as a revision. You can absolutely see this as a revisionist Western. You can also see this without that context at all. It makes it interesting to watch, certainly, if you think of that. But I think you can easily be forgiven for watching and that have that never occur to you once. Although there are moments, I think, you know, there's a funeral for a minor character, and then Keith Carradine's cowboy comes into town.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we see a face-off. We actually witness a face-off.
Right.
And he's just some kid.
He's just some kid.
And so there are iconic images that do occur. But I think for the most part, what I loved about this film, and I think this film made me realize or be able to articulate or hopefully articulate, I'll try to, what I love about Altman in a way that I don't know if I was as aware of in other films. And it's this lack of ego. Altman has no ego, and he seems to make the screenwriter sacrifice their ego and all the actors sacrifice their ego in his attempt to create life on screen, the illusion of life on screen. I was reading Pauline Kael's original review of this film, and she talks about Julie Christie and Warren Beatty just happening to be the most interesting people on screen.
Mm-hmm.
But Altman is paying attention to everyone, and I think that's where the power of it is. And I was thinking of, you know, Altman has had failures in his career, but it's almost watching this kind of film where it's really a sense of focused improvisation. Like, he's just trying to capture the sense of improvisation, but he's absolutely focused and knows exactly what he wants, but he's letting people arrive at it in their own way. The audience arrive at it in their own way. It's amazing he didn't have more in some way, because he doesn't seem to impose any directorial vision. You're talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, industrialization rears its head, and you made some wonderful points thematically in terms of, you know, why doesn't she get more involved in Warren Beatty's character, or why doesn't she let a relationship develop? But he's never forcing any of those themes on you. And it's interesting. I mean, the characters, there's a sense where you have this unique privilege as an audience member. I certainly felt it, where he not only brings you into the scene, like, you're sitting there in the bar with him, and you can sort of just, the camera allows you to sort of avert your gaze to another conversation happening. And it never seems like that conversation is happening just because the camera is on. And it's just like you fill in the reality in some way. And it's interesting. You're so attuned to the life and the rhythm of life in these films. And then all of a sudden you do have the outsiders that come in that represent the company, the mining company. And they want to buy out McCabe. And it's almost like they really are emissaries from another world entirely. Mm-hmm. I mean, they literally are, but they also are advancing the plot in the way that no other character does in some way. Certainly there's an advance of plot when Julie Christie comes, or when McCabe first comes to town, yeah. The rhythm changes. When Christie comes to town, the rhythm changes. But these people that are come in, they're here to buy McCabe. It's like, we're here to introduce the plot as well. And it's, you've been watching this for an hour and 15 minutes. And I was so aware, you know, you watch this and I think watching Great Altman can ruin you. Certainly watching the Nativity Story after this, you realize what Altman does so well in terms of just like bringing to life an entire ensemble of performers. And somebody like Hardwick can't even bring her main characters into a sense of life and reality.
But yeah.
I really was blown away by this. And, you know, yes, thematically, but also just watching Altman work his magic as an artist is really something.
It really is. And I really love how you bring up the Nativity Story only because I didn't watch them in that order. And now that you mention it, exactly all those things I was calling for that weren't in the Nativity Story, Altman could have brought to that. I would have loved to see Robert Altman's version of that story, where I believe he would have had some respect for the story he's telling, just in
no
terms
question.
Of religious or not, just in terms of the scale of it. It recognizing that people adore this story and have lived with it for several thousands of years or
there's
whatever.
A reason it has its
exactly.
power, yeah.
But he wouldn't have had the reverence. He would have been willing, the total reverence. He would have been willing to take chances and let these people be people completely,
right.
Whereas I don't think that Hardwick ever really does. So I agree with you, McCabe. Really, I'm so glad that we finally got a chance to watch this film. It is something that's been one that we've regretted for a long time. The cinematography, of course, is another thing that really stands out. Vilmos Zsigmond, he shoots it where there is this glow, and you know the story is behind it, of course, that he shot it deliberately that way rather than doing effects after he shot it so that they couldn't change it. The studio couldn't do anything about it. They can't,
right.
It was shot that way. It's going to have that kind of glow to it, that tint to it, and everyone's just going to have to deal with it. And it looks great, and what's so amazing about it is that glow of it contrasts with the grubbiness and the real squalor of this town, Presbyterian Church. It's a place that's usually raining or very muddy, and it just doesn't look like fun, but it's so fun to look at just because of the way it's shot. And, you know, Beatty and Christie, I really underrated Warren Beatty for a long time, and now that I see Reds and I see McCabe, I really think he's a fantastic actor. I was never a big fan of like Bulworth, for example, but I think he's really great here, and their love story is amazing, even though it's ridiculous to even call it a love story because it's so unconventional, but they have a comfort together, I think not just Christie and Beatty, but the way it's written and the way it's directed, that it makes it seem like they belong together. Like, they're the two most interesting people in this town. Well, they somehow need to be on screen together. They belong together in this town. There's something about them that draws each to the other, and it works. It makes perfect sense.
And I was reading some reviews of this too, where they describe his character as a dumb character in some way, and that's revealed. His like lack of sophistication,
I think that comes
is
out certainly.
Revealed. Yes, but it's like he never plays him as a dumb guy,
no,
and that's
not
the
at
thing.
All.
And it's like it seems unfair, and so it doesn't reveal at all in terms of the character that that Warren Beatty is playing. And
sure.
I agree. I mean, usually I feel like Warren Beatty has, you know, this charisma that overpowers his, and even Reds. It's like,
yeah.
It's Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
And that's fine because
that's
he
the way
has
he has to
charisma.
Be,
absolutely. Yeah.
Reed has to be that
but
way.
This is a really fascinating character that I don't think it equals anything else I've seen him
Maybe
do.
Not.
All right. But again, of course, we highly
we
recommend
do.
It. Next week, we will return to our regularly scheduled animation marathon with Katsuhiro Otomo's Akira.
We're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, the sun even shines on a dog's ass some days. Our top five good movies from bad directors is next. And if you recognize that last quote, Sam, you'll know one of the directors I'll be singling out. Back in a moment. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, it's Austin from Cincinnati, and I was just recently listening to your podcast, and I heard your top five adrenaline rushes, and what immediately came to mind for me was The Deer Hunter. I just remember that scene where Russian roulette scene with Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro, and for me that was the most powerful scene in like any movie I've ever seen. I just remember being literally out of breath when that entire scene was over. Just a great movie and a great scene.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and that was another piece of audio feedback. Austin in Cincinnati talking about The Deer Hunter, our top five adrenaline rush scenes, and I'm not going to argue with any scene from The Deer Hunter, kind of closing out that feedback there. We appreciate that, Austin.
Maybe not a scene or a film you use to test out your surround sound.
Exactly.
But powerful and adrenaline rushing nonetheless.
Certainly. Okay. Well, we also want to get to some top five feedback from last week's top five ambitious movies. We heard a little bit earlier from Josh. Why don't you read this one, Sam, from our good friend, M. Robert Turnage,
who gives us actually six, including this one, Pink Flamingos. Just because it is bad doesn't mean it can't be ambitiously bad. Not a film I've seen.
No, I haven't
either. Nor can I say I'm looking forward to it. Cult films, maybe a marathon. Maybe a cult film marathon at some point.
We've actually had that recommended.
All right. Number five, Seven Samurai. There is a famous story about how Kurosawa spent so much on this film that he nearly bankrupted the studio twice. And unlike Apocalypse Now, this film is good.
Ouch.
M. Robert Turnage writes. Number four, The Conversation. Coppola's best movie and certainly an interesting film to make at that point in his career. Dropping the bombs all over the place, M. Robert. Number three, Videodrome, Cronenberg's best movie. Number two, The Red Shoes. Any movie that sets out to inspire the audience to die for art is ambitious. And number one, A Tie, Trois Couleurs, and Decalogue. So what is more ambitious? A three film series meditating on the colors of the French flag and the themes they represent in the context of a unified Europe destroying national identities, or a 10-film series that meditates on each of the 10 commandments. Only Krzysztof Kieślowski knows for sure.
I think
took it with him to the grave.
I think even more ambitious is M. Robert Turnage's last point there in the email. That sentence alone,
that's exactly,
you know, is ambitious. But
that's a run-on ambitiously long sentence.
You're right. Yeah. The Conversation, Coppola's best film, better than The Godfather.
Amazing.
Okay.
We just want to remind people that that was stated.
Sure. Okay. And he hates Kill Bill as well and Apocalypse Now, and that's fine.
You know, he's our nemesis.
He is our nemesis. That is true. Let's close out with this one from Brian Z in California, Maryland. Great top five list, and I want to throw a bizarre one out there for ambitious films. Before Sunset. I think M. Robert Turnage hates this choice too, probably. It doesn't have the scale or scope of others, but it is ambitious no less. Making a sequel for a film with only a minor, if loyal, following, and truly letting the characters be who they are, in a real-time frame no less, was a bold choice. That ending is one of the most memorable of recent memory. Oh, and I guess one more, Eternal Sunshine. Sure, it's always mentioned, but with a script like that, to which the actors admitted to having no clue if it would work, and considering how well it did, certainly ambitious.
Well put, of course.
I think
couldn't
Gondry
agree more.
And Kaufman can kind of go into that ambitious category.
I mentioned
and
them last week,
I like Before Sunset because
me too.
I mentioned to you that, you know, I had Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring on there because you're taking something that has a rabid fan base and you're potentially going to piss off all these people. Well, Before Sunset isn't nearly that big, but deciding to make a sequel to that film that does have this following that people adore, you run the risk of almost ruining the memory of that film if this film doesn't work.
It fits totally the criteria I think I used, where I was like, you saw that they were making the film, and you were like, oh, great, good luck with that.
Uh-huh.
You're going to ruin it. It's going to be terrible, of course. But
and then they pull it off.
Totally pull it off, and I can't agree more about the ending of that film. One of my favorites in recent memory.
Yep, I agree. I'm with both of you.
All
okay,
right.
This week's top five, again, we were searching for a topic. I don't know, was this one a listener suggested?
No, or I maybe thought of it months ago, and it sort of fit.
It's kind of like,
this
it
week.
Ties in with that movies we should have loved and movies we should have hated, and this is good movies by directors we don't really like. And saying that they're bad, I don't know that I can say all these directors are bad.
Not at all.
But just when you look at their body of work, all of a sudden they have kind of a gem that sticks out, and you kind of think, wow, I didn't expect that. Is that fair enough?
That's totally fair.
Okay.
And I will say, I think as I was doing this, I realized a shadow list was forming. Top five movies I hate by directors I love, which I think will be a future top five.
It's been recommended a couple times. We will do it.
Yes. Yeah. So, top five, my five. I feel like this is a weak entry, but it fits because it's one of my favorite movies by a director who hasn't done anything that nearly matches it, and it's Barry Sonnenfeld's Get Shorty,
good
film
choice.
I love. But the reason I put this on particularly was cinematographer, for the Coen brothers, Miller's mm-hmm. Crossing. One of the first cinematographers I think I was aware of in terms of that role, because that movie is gorgeous to look at.
Which one?
Miller's Crossing.
Okay, yeah.
And
Blood Simple as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. And then he, he does the Addams Family. Addams Family Values, I think, his first couple films that he directed. Then he does Get Shorty, which I think is one of my favorite comedies of all time. I love the film. Seen it countless times. Men in Black, I can totally do away with it. Wild Wild West, Big Trouble, Men in Black 2, mm-hmm. RV,
yeah.
Most recently. Oh, this guy is going nowhere but down. And I feel like the guy who made Get Shorty is capable of making a film at least nearly equal to it, and he hasn't in now, gosh, we're going on 12 years.
Yeah, great choice. Really a great choice. I can't believe I overlooked him. You're right. That's the only good film in that bunch.
Yeah.
Well, wait, Men in Black, I think, is okay, the first. But you're right. That's the only real good film on
obviously
there.
Obviously a talented, creative guy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is now the Barry Sonnenfeld Memorial Where Are You list. But actually, we should say we have a memorial name for this list.
Oh,
it is
the
Tony Scott True Romance Memorial list. Okay, so again, Tony Scott, the guy who gave us a few films that I like or even consider guilty pleasures: Man on Fire, Enemy of the State, Crimson Tide, Spy Game, of course, Top Gun.
Yes,
those films are all fine, but then you also have Revenge, The Last Boy Scout, The Fan, Domino. You could go
Tony Scott has never pretended to make a film other than what he's making.
Exactly.
I mean, you got to give the guy credit for that.
You do. And so we're giving him credit with the True Romance Memorial list here. My number five shouldn't be a big shock to anyone who remembers this previous overlooked DVD pick of mine. It's actually the movie Tigerland from Joel Schumacher. Joel Schumacher, really probably my least favorite director of all time. I have a few guilty pleasures from the 80s that he made: The Lost Boys, San Elmo's Fire, Flatliners.
Lost
I like
Boys.
All three of those films.
Yep.
But then you get to A Time to Kill, Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, Falling Down, which I don't like, Dying Young, 8mm, Bad Company, The Client, Phantom of the Opera.
I'm squirming in my seat.
I know, and here he takes this stripped down. This was his attempt at a kind of an indie movie. Colin Farrell in his breakout role, and I think he's good in it. Vietnam era story, going through boot camp, like in Louisiana, I think in the 60s, in the early 60s, I believe. And I really think Tigerland is a pretty engaging film. The one thing I will say, I've always wanted to see Veronica Guerin with Cate Blanchett. I didn't know he directed that.
I didn't either.
So maybe that's another good film he's made, but that's my number five, Tigerland from Joel Schumacher.
Good pick. I revoked this director's directing license earlier this year.
Oh, wow.
Brian De Palma.
Oh, yeah.
And funny it came up on the show because, I'm sorry, but I want to revoke Catherine Hardwick's
You do?
Directing
You're
card,
only giving her
DMA
three?
Card. I am just furious with her. She doesn't know how to direct, as far as I can tell.
Okay.
I was a production designer
earlier.
Even though,
aren't you giving her latest film three stars?
I'm telling you, if you want to see the nativity story,
uh-huh.
I'm saying, like, go ahead.
Okay.
I'm not going to deny you the pleasure of watching A Shaft of Light fall on baby Jesus.
Uh-huh.
But, Brian De Palma, I'm going with Blowout, a film that I saw in the wake of Pulp Fiction. Like, I want to see more John Travolta when he was awesome. I had no idea how awesome he was. And I really liked this film.
It's okay.
And I liked, that's the thing. I mean, I'm kind of afraid to revisit it. I do remember, I mean, I love, John Lithgow is the bad guy.
Yeah.
He's great as the bad guy. I remember kind of liking Raising Kain for that scene.
Wow.
I don't know where I'm going with this. But I mean, Brian De Palma, but I do think, I am afraid, if I went to revisit it, I would realize all it is another Brian De Palma film.
Yeah.
Because I do remember the first scene in Blowout actually is the film that John Travolta's character is scoring. He's a sound guy.
Right.
And of course, there's a bunch of nude girls in a shower.
Uh-huh.
And it's like Brian
it
De Palma, because if a woman's on screen, you're just waiting for her to take her clothes off. I'm going with Blowout, 1981, John Travolta.
His envisioning, re-envisioning of Antonioni's film, Blow Up.
That probably doesn't help.
No, it probably doesn't. Okay, well, my number four is the movie Bull Durham, baseball movie, comedy,
sure.
One of my all-time favorite sports movies, maybe my number two behind Field of Dreams, favorite sports movie from director Ron Shelton. A lot of people like Tin Cup with Kevin Costner. I think it's bad.
Yikes.
Hollywood Homicide with Josh Hartnett and Harrison Ford is pretty bad. And then movies that are either bad or I had no desire to see. I can't really say I ever wanted to see Blaze. Cobb is bad. And I'm telling you, play it to the bone. I saw that in the theater.
Oh.
And it is one of the worst movie-going experiences I ever had. It's terrible. I mean, it's just a debacle of a film.
Well, I remember my brother wanted to have a category of films that are Cobb bad.
Yeah.
I remember.
There you go.
Yeah, so.
Well, so the one guilty pleasure, it's the one I referenced in the tease. I do love White Men Can't Jump. We watched it in college over and over again. I like White Men Can't Jump, but I have not seen Dark Blue, his other film with Kurt Russell about kind of corrupt cops in L.A., but
like
if you
Russell.
Look at Ron Shelton's body of work, Bull Durham really stands out as the only really good film, I think.
Oh, I'm going out on a limb here for my number three. I'm nervous. Alexander Payne's Election.
Okay.
This was a surprise.
The gloves
that
are off.
But I look at his Citizen Ruth, about Schmidt, Sideways, three films that are way overpraised. But I think I want to curtail that a little bit by saying I personally don't like them because of what I see as Payne's vision. I think he's got such a cynic in some way, and I do feel like the subject matter that he explores, he seems to have a contempt for some of the characters that he's satirizing. And I really don't enjoy. I mean, the guy's smart, obviously. He has great writing partners. He goes with great material. Mm-hmm. He gets great performances out of actors. And I really dislike, I just feel like he has a completely unsympathetic tone that really, I think, corrupts the films, the pleasure of the films. Really didn't like Sideways. Thought Jack Nicholson ruined About Schmidt, but I think the movie has other problems. Election has the same problems, I think, in terms of the cynicism of his vision in some way, the contempt he has for his subject matter, in terms of politics, if he's satirizing politics. But it works, I think, in this scenario. There it is.
Okay. Well, you can think about for the rest of the segment how you can satirize something that you don't have contempt for, and I'll look forward to that explanation. My number three, though, moving on, The Manchurian Candidate, the original Manchurian Candidate from director John Frankenheimer, I believe 1962. And Frankenheimer is a guy a lot of people revere. He's made a ton of films. He recently passed away, and there are a lot of films of his I haven't seen. I'll admit to, like, The Iceman Cometh, The Birdman of Alcatraz, Black Sunday. But this is a guy who made Ronin, which is okay, The General's Daughter, and Reindeer Games. And my point is, The Manchurian Candidate is a masterpiece, probably. And then you look at his body of work, whether it's films I have seen or haven't seen, nothing else really jumps out as wow, he really made a bunch of really good to great films. I don't see him there, but Manchurian Candidate certainly stands out.
Nice pick. All right. I guess unsympathetic. Contempt makes sense. Okay, contempt, you wouldn't satirize something you don't have some level of contempt
right.
for. I'm saying it's too dark and too unsympathetic a vision.
Shiny, happy Sam.
That's me.
Okay.
Speaking of shiny, happy Sam, my number two, Tim Burton. Again, don't get me wrong.
I considered
him. Loved Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, Batman, but really from, and even I don't love Edward Scissorhands or Batman Returns, Ed Wood's fine, but since Ed Wood, there was nothing that would prepare me for how much I liked Big Fish. And it has a kind of, here we go, shiny, happy whimsy that I think is completely different from the dark kind of whimsy that you'd use to describe any of his other films, really. Ewan McGregor's performance in that, thank you for casting Ewan McGregor and not our friend Johnny Depp, because I think that was part of it. Ewan McGregor is wonderful in this movie. I had such a good time, and it's a really moving and imaginative film. Really,
it's a good film. You're right. I love, this is what you gotta love or hate about Sam Van Hogren. He's bringing out the bat. He's just cracking, taking shots at the pinata of Tim Burton, Alexander Payne, all these big directors. I'm taking shots at Ron Shelton and Joel Schumacher.
You man, you.
I know, I'm such a man here. I'm so bold. My number two, it just continues with How Dare I? I guess he did recently pass away as well, but my number two is the movie Tombstone, a Western I love, the director George P. Cosmatos. He made,
I don't even know what to say to that.
George P. Cosmatos made from 1985 to 1989.
Oh, dear.
We'll remember this string like we'll remember The Godfather, The Godfather 2, and The Conversation. He made Rambo First Blood Part 2, Cobra, and Leviathan.
Oh.
So nothing really could have prepared me for Tombstone, though, as I'm sure some of our listeners would want me to point out right now, it is true that if you read that recent interview with Kurt Russell basically says he directed Tombstone.
Kurt Russell directed
yes,
it?
Yes. George P. Cosmatos died recently.
Yes.
And Kurt Russell came out and said in an interview,
In honor of the death of Cosmatos.
He said, I basically directed that film. When they fired Kevin Jarry, the screenwriter, as the director, he basically got to take over. And Cosmatos just said, I'll just do what you want me to do. And that's what happened. So maybe Kurt Russell needs
to... Where is Kurt Russell's directorial debut? I'm waiting for it. The Cosmatos fans are going to be furious. You're going to hear from them. My number one, frequently and fairly accused of being a sentimentalist, Ron Howard, but nothing would have prepared me in the past 10 years. Again, I'll go back and absolutely love Splash. Love Cocoon.
Right.
I even liked Apollo 13, parts of it. But since then, he'd done nothing that would prepare me for how much I liked and was moved by Cinderella Man last summer.
Okay.
And really, anybody, it's amazing to me. I mean, he had just made a film I hated, Beautiful Mind, was in the process... when Cinderella Man came out, in the process of making a truly terrible film, The Da Vinci Code.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't even believe with Ron Howard, I have so much sympathy. He, you know, was behind the creation of Arrested Development, a genius sitcom. I can't believe anybody associated with Arrested Development could have anything to do with the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
It's like he compartmentalizes. He's got two minds.
Uh-huh.
Because I do like Ron Howard.
Okay. Well, Cinderella Man
is my choice, number one.
You know, it's funny because I tell you, I watch it every time it's on TV. I was watching it yesterday. It's on HBO, and I'm
watching it.
You
couldn't get enough. You missed crying over Grave of Fireflies. And you're like,
exactly. Yeah. And my wife goes, what is it with you in this film? And I go, I don't know. You should watch it. It's good. Isn't this depressing you?
Russell
He's begging
Crowe.
For money. Come on.
This is good stuff. This is gold.
I definitely considered Ron Howard, but the thing is, unlike you, I will admit to really liking A Beautiful Mind.
And TV, then, yeah.
Yeah, and I like Apollo and TV, yeah. I like Apollo
and
13.
Missing with Tommy Lee Jones, right?
Well, you know what? I've heard some decent things about
sure.
that. I never saw it. But
Blanchett.
Splash, Night Shift, yeah. Beautiful Mind, Apollo right. 13. I couldn't put Howard on. I couldn't
right.
put him under the guillotine. But I will put under here, this is maybe a somewhat bold choice.
All right.
But not as bold as you, I'll
no.
admit. Certainly not. But I'm going with my number one is Boys in the Hood from director John Singleton.
Wow.
Shaft is really not a good film, even though we enjoy watching, you know, Jeffrey
Christian
Wright
Bale,
and Christian
Jeffrey
Bale
Wright,
in it.
Yeah.
And I do have to admit that I really like the film Baby Boy, actually,
right.
with Tyrese Gibson. But Higher Learning, Poetic Justice, Too Fast, Too Furious, and Four Brothers. I haven't seen Rosewood, I'll admit. I haven't seen Rosewood. I want to see that. I know that generally got good reviews. But
right.
you look at those films, I think Boys in the Hood, it's his first film.
As good
and still
as Four Brothers is, right?
As
That's
good
what you're
as
saying.
It is, uh-huh. that Boys in the Hood is still his masterpiece
yeah.
for his first
That's
film.
That's a good
and
pick.
He's made some bad films. That's my number one.
All right. That's our list. We welcome yours. Opening in wide release this weekend, Mel Gibson's Apocalypto, Ed Zwick's Blood Diamond, The Holiday with Cameron Diaz and Kate Winslet, and Unaccompanied Minors, based on a piece that originally appeared on This American Life.
This American Life, where you used to work,
the babysitting
your old stomping
episode,
grounds.
Look for
Do you
it.
Want to explain to our listeners, Sam, actually why your name gets heard periodically on the podcast?
Yeah, I guess I explained that probably while I was doing it, but I was the production manager for This American Life for about 6 months in 05, 06. So
when they're podcasting, are they playing old shows?
Yeah,
that
when
you
they play old shows,
of?
If you listen to the credits, you'll every once in a while hear anything. Any new show that was produced between October 05 and May 06
yeah.
will...
Minus the
production
man,
thanks.
It's Sam Hallgren.
Sam
it's
Hallgren,
not just
me.
Ira Glass being disrespectful like me of your new name.
That's right.
Okay. Well, please send any feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. It's a new month. A direct link is available on our blog on the right side under Vote for Film Spotting, also on the right side of our main page. Sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast. I think, Sam, you had a particularly good Dope Sheet this week.
Oh, great. Yeah, it was a great edition.
I really liked it. Okay.
Thanks to Dead String Brothers and Bloodshot Records for today's music. Please check them out on the web at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Swap your unwanted DVDs for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by Favre Forever, now on DVD.
Favre Forever takes an in-depth look at Brett Favre's career from his high school and college days through his NFL career. From a near-fatal car accident to his unsuccessful rookie NFL season to an unforgettable Monday Night Football performance 24 hours after his father's death to a glorious victory in Super Bowl 31. Favre Forever is narrated by Billy Bob Thornton and packed with highlights and rarely seen footage. It's the ultimate tribute to one of the NFL's greats.
The much-anticipated Favre Forever, now on DVD and available at profootballdvd.com.
Check, check, mic check. 10-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Hallgren. This week on the show... Oh, my God. Jesus. It's like Ricky Gervais's Extras, where Ben Stiller is... Should we get into that?
No. Well, maybe, yeah. Gervais, isn't it?
Is it Gervais?
Is it Gervais? I don't know.
I think it's Gervais, yeah.
You should say that, yeah.
It's like Ricky Gervais's Extras, where Ben... It's like Ricky... It's like Ricky... I keep wanting to say Richie. This is... Like, we are manufacturing outtakes. There's going to be more outtake than show.